I don't think Maklakoff's pursuit of the center ever had any adverse effects. And I think it had mild, limited, in the context of extreme polarization, beneficent effects. So I think it can never be wrong to pursue intelligent moderation. I don't mean moderation in the sense of splitting the difference, but well thought out ideas that are promising solutions to problems.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, February 24th, 2018. Stephen Williams is a senior judge on the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. In his spare time, he is a historian of reformist movements in the Russian pre-revolutionary period. In this latter capacity, he recently published a book, The Reformer, How One Liberal Fought to Preempt the Russian Revolution, a book about Vasily Maklakoff, a lawyer, Duma member, and public intellectual who offered his country an alternative path from the road it took in 1917. I sat down with Judge Williams to talk about Maklakoff. We talked about Russia's prospects for reform in 1917 and now, about political moderation, and about the flight to extremes. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 286, Stephen Williams on Vasily Maklakoff. Who was Vasily Maklakoff, and why should we be thinking about him today?
Well, if you believe, as I do, that the greatest challenge posed to humankind is the one articulated by Madison. I think it's in Federalist number 10, I'm not sure which, maybe 51. If men were angels, be no need for government, as they are not. We need government, but then we need institutions that constrain government from acting as badly as ungoverned men might act. And Maklakoff was squarely on the side and articulately on the side. And I think, to the extent that circumstances permitted, effectively on the side of advancing that concept in pre-revolutionary Russia, to the point that if he had succeeded, Russia might have averted the Bolshevik Revolution, might therefore have avoided decades of tyranny, associated with, to bring it to the lawfare focus, extended warfare and killing and struggle.
So that articulation could be true at any time in the last 100 years, and that is the rule of law is always important, heading off revolutionary movements that lead to war and famine and oppression and suffering is always important. And yet there is some reason, I think, why, from your point of view, you timed the book to the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution. There's some reason why this is all on your mind these days.
Well, the reason, I mean, you should remember that I started the book, it's now 12 years ago, so current events were not at all on my mind. But to my mind, looking at relatively recent history, the last 200 years, one of the perhaps the signal event is the Bolshevik Revolution and the impact that it had on certainly the 100 years after the Bolshevik Revolution, so that if it could have been averted, if Russia could instead have evolved into a constitutional monarchy, that would have been an extraordinary transformation. I mean, the effects of that would have been felt for the next 100 years.
It still would.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. And the other thing I want to say is that it may be that Russia's opportunity to move to any kind of liberal democracy, constitutional monarchy, or whatever, is very limited. But I tend to think that this period from 1905 to 1917 was the best shot so far that Russia has ever had at it. So that the feeling of coming close but not quite making it is always with me. And one of the fun things about studying the period is to see bits of progress being made and opportunities that were really there and sometimes pursued. And then, of course, the sorrow of the period is that they didn't make it.
This is actually the second book that you have written about the subject of early 20th century reformers whose names we have forgotten from the pre-revolutionary Russian period. The first one was about Stolypin. I'm curious, there is a sort of larger theme here, which is the road not taken. And why the interest in the path that wasn't taken in Russia?
Well, I guess in some sense that's easy. I mean, I should say I was brought up in a Cold War family, in the sense that at the family dinner table, the nature of Stalin's government and his successors was a regular topic. A guest from time to time, not a frequent guest, but from time to time, was Frieda Uttley, who was a British communist journalist who met a representative of a Soviet trade mission in London, fell in love, married him, moved with him to Moscow, and in 1937, the knock came on the door of their apartment, and her husband was taken off to the Gulag, and as they later learned, was shot actually trying to lead a rebellion against the Gulag guards. A fairly rare event. That gave me a strong feeling about the nature of the Soviet regime. And so I guess a sort of central concern of mine has always been, how do you avoid that sort of thing? And then when the Soviet regime fell in 1991, a very strong question in my mind was, what will succeed it? And what is there in Russia's past that might have lessons about how to work out of that. So that's central to my view of Maklakov.
One of the things that's very striking in the book is your account of polarized politics. So you describe in the introduction Maklakov as the center of the center. On his right are Octoberist constitutionalists who are kind of conservative constitutionalists who are interested in things like private property but are not so interested in things like anti-discrimination with respect to Jews and Finns and Poles. And on his left, people who are pretty ambivalent about the idea of private property. And then on the extremes, you have the people who became the Bolshevik revolutionaries and the, for that matter, the non-Bolshevik revolutionaries. And on the other hand, you know, really violent anti-Semites and people who were absolute monarchists. You're a judge, and I'm not going to ask you to talk about contemporary politics or any contemporary political figures, but I was very struck by your sense of the role of the center in a polarized political environment. And I'm just interested for your thoughts on, you know, as you've looked around the world over the last few years and you see sort of creeping authoritarianism in Poland, in Hungary, and rise of radical left parties in places like Greece, you know, there does have this feeling of the center not holding. And I'm curious for your thoughts on somebody like Maklakov as almost a kind of archetypal, like trying to hold the center as things splinter.
I think that's a fair characterization of him. It's certainly one that I would endorse. And you come up against the question, can it work? Well, the two things: is it right to try it? And second, can it work? And let me put it this way. I don't think Maklakoff's pursuit of the center ever had any adverse effects. And I think it had mild, limited, in the context of extreme polarization, beneficent effects. So I think it can never be wrong to pursue intelligent moderation. I don't mean moderation in the sense of splitting the difference, but well thought out ideas that are promising solutions to problems. And if people don't listen the first time, maybe they'll listen the second time, and so forth. I think that does it succeed? Well, obviously, in 1917, it failed. But once we've settled the first problem, if we have, that it never does harm, the fact that it didn't succeed is unfortunate, but not a reason not to try.
So give us an overview of Maklakoff's life and career. Who was he, and what was his importance in his day?
He's born in 1869. His father is an ophthalmologist and a clinician, two things that naturally I think go together.
I got to say, other than the gulag, I'm not sure that anything could be more terrifying than 1870s era Russian ophthalmology.
Well, that's
just putting that on the table.
That's quite unfair. Maklakoff, the father, was published in French journals of ophthalmology. He was a real scientist. Maklakoff's mother was very well educated and well read, and also very religious, which is certainly rare for that time. Because the intelligentsia did not go in for religion and tended to scoff at religion. So there was in the family environment already a kind of cross-cultural life. So I hasten to add that his father never scoffed, was not one of the scoffers, and that was a lesson that Maklakoff absorbed. So it was a family, a household of respect for what were seen, at least, as competing ideas. He goes to the university. He turned to history, where he did extremely well, and the leading light of Moscow University in history of the day was Paul Vinogradov, who appeared to admire him greatly and have him in mind for a professorship at Moscow University. But there was a guy named Bogolepov who was up in the hierarchy of Moscow University, who was heard to say — Maklakoff doesn't say who heard it exactly, but he seems to have said it, it seems quite plausible — while I am at this institution, Maklakoff will never become a professor. Well, those were daunting words to the budding historian. And so, on the verge of getting a degree in history, he switched to law. And because of family circumstances, his father's death and the loss of the place to live, he felt he had to do it very quickly. And he did law school in 9 months, but got the top honors in it. At one point, he was issued what is called a wolf's passport, which is very strange because it isn't a passport to anything except possibly oblivion. And that is, it meant you cannot come back to the university unless something happens to relieve you of this mark.
Just the opposite of a passport.
The opposite of a passport, exactly. And that relief did come only through the fact of Maklakoff's father having some good connections with authority figures. So the ruin of his education and thus career, almost certainly his career as well, didn't happen, but it was only through a trick of fate. So one of the puzzles in the book, which I note but I don't try to solve, is So why was Vasily Maklakov so different from his brother Nikolai? The difference between them is, I think, best seen in their roles in the Bayliss trial, Menachem Bayliss being a Jew accused of murder because he happened to be A, Jewish, and B, within some distance, but not a huge distance, obviously, of where the corpse of some poor child who had been murdered was found.
And he was accused of, in the classic blood libel.
Blood libel, exactly.
Using the blood of a Christian baby to create matzah.
Exactly. So in this trial, Maklakov is the certainly the most distinguished of the lawyers on the defense side and stalwartly defending Bayliss against this, and I hasten to add, getting him off. On the other side, as Minister of Internal Affairs, was Nikolai Maklakov, who was shepherding, I guess it's fair to say, the prosecution, including such fishy things as eavesdropping on the jury to get day-by-day reports as to what they were thinking. As someone observed, it must have been disappointing because the jurors apparently kept saying, doesn't seem to be really any evidence against him, which was right. So you have these two completely different people arising out of the same family, and I did develop what seemed to me things in the family background that might tend to explain where Maklakov ended up fitting. Why did Nikolai fit that way? And the only answer I can come up with, which is entirely speculative, is that Maklakov, having been the target of state arbitrariness and having escaped it within an inch of his life, came to feel very, very strongly about state arbitrariness. Well, as far as I could make out, nothing of the sort happened to Nikolai. He was a reasonably smart fellow. He rose in the hierarchy and did what the management team expected of him.
Okay, so he's a bit of a scraper in college.
I draw the lesson that if your kid is a bit rebellious, shouldn't be too worried. Maybe that means he'll be a great champion of the rule of law.
So he becomes a lawyer. He becomes a lawyer with a kind of passionate opposition to government arbitrariness. And then he becomes a politician. So fill in that piece.
He was very gregarious and smart, and I think that enabled him to make friends among people in the liberation movement, which essentially moved into the Constitutional Democratic Party. And he was at the founding meeting of the Constitutional Democratic Party. His role there deserves some note because it combines two features of him. One is there's a policeman there who's intruded essentially into it, obviously an eavesdropper, and apparently perfectly obviously a policeman, not a true undercover guy. So Maklakov asks for the floor and speaks generally about the possible risks to a police officer who invades a private house without adequate justification. And he does this so convincingly that the policeman wanders off. So this was Maklakov using his lawyerly skills to protect essentially a private political gathering. Now, the other thing that he does is there's a lot of talk about the government unduly eavesdropping, reading people's mail, all kinds of things that we naturally think of as bad. And Maklakov evidently took to the floor on that.
The floor of the Duma, you mean?
No, this is the floor of the organization meeting of the Constitutional Democratic Party, to observe that at some point, and say the nickname for these is the cadets, that at some point the cadets might actually be the government, and it might be, they might think it necessary to use such measures. So they should perhaps not speak so, you know, so clearly, so irrevocably, so strongly against their ever being used.
It reminds me a little bit of Barack Obama in 2008 when confronted by the FISA 702 reauthorization, which the Democratic Party kind of inveighs against, I guess the original authorization, right? Not the reauthorization. And he votes for it in the midst of a the primaries, actually, and takes some heat from the left of the Democratic Party on the theory that, you know, I might actually end up
being
president.
This. Right, right. Well, no, I think that it's good to think ahead and to think of, even apart from thinking ahead, it's good to think of how things look from another point of view. And I think it's fair to say that Maklakov emerges as a staunch proponent of ordered liberty. I should say that when I first heard that phrase, I was sort of offended because I was staunchly in favor of liberty, and the idea of ordered liberty made me nervous. But I've come over the years to think that ordered liberty is what you have to have, because disordered liberty is not going to be liberty for long.
So describe the overall constellation of politics. I gave a very brief overview, but so he's right in the center representing ordered liberty. It does not have that much of a constituency at that point. What are the major currents in Russian politics in the period 1900 to 1917?
Yeah. The cadets are obsessed with constitutional structure, and they regard perhaps England, although in certain respects they have an ideal which is more liberal or more democratic than England actually was at the time. But when the Tsar makes reforms, starting with the October Manifesto in October 1905, and then fleshed out in revisions of the fundamental laws in the spring of 1906, they are deeply offended, and also a new electoral law. They're deeply offended by three things. One is the franchise is not democratic enough for them. I should say it's interesting, the franchise was democratic by the standards of the day, essentially nearly universal male suffrage, but it was also twisted in the sense that there were the system of indirect voting, so that above all big landowners had a disproportionate voice in selecting delegates to the Duma. So it was democratic in one sense but undemocratic in another. They were insistent that it be totally democratic all the way through. A second thing is they objected overwhelmingly to the existence of the state council, or rather the power of the state council, which existed before but was transformed in the 1906 fundamental laws into the upper house of the legislature, which meant that a bill could pass the Duma without becoming law. Now, interestingly, they never really focused on the Tsar's retention of a veto, I think because everyone seemed to regard the state council as kind of his cat's paw. It would do the dirty work for the Tsar, although it seems very doubtful that in a strong situation it would really take the heat off him. But it was a much more conservative body. So they were very obsessed about that. And the third thing they were obsessed about was that the government was not responsible to the Duma in the sense that it would be in Britain. If you lose the confidence of the Duma, you're out, and Milyukov is the actual head of the cadet party and is obsessed with these things. Maklakov is sympathetic in varying degrees on them, but he certainly doesn't think that they should be the be-all and the end-all of political activity. In the first Duma, he's not in the first Duma, but in the first Duma, the cadets take the position, nothing should happen until these three things are straightened out. Not a promising way to go forward. So that's one, the sort of overall constitutional issue is one problem. Second problem is agrarian reform. And here, I think because of his involvement in the Constitutional Democratic Party, Maklakov did not make as great a contribution as he could have. That he clearly disagreed with the position of the cadets. And the position of the cadets is really quite extraordinary when you think of it. They absolutely, furiously resisted the Stolypin reforms, which were an effort to allow peasants in communes to exit the commune and to have something approximating, not good enough by my lights, but something approximating private property. They were vehemently against that. And what they favored was complete redistribution of the so-called landowner's land, landowners meaning owners of land who are not peasants, complete redistribution of that with some degree of compensation for the landowners. They never spelled out what it would be, but at least that made them more generous than the socialist revolutionaries. And then what absolutely staggers me is instead of giving this land, they talked about giving the land to the peasants, this land captured from the landowners, but they didn't actually have that in mind. What they had in mind was sort of letting it to the peasants, allocating it to the peasants on a continuing basis, very much the way the old communes had, so that a peasant would never, under their vision of the future, would never have private property and land. And the government would have this extraordinary discretionary power.
So on their left are the socialist revolutionaries. On their right are the sort of more conservative constitutionalists and ultimately the autocrats. How hollowed out was the center? I mean, was Maklakov somebody who ultimately represented, you know, sort of the way we think of these modern liberals in Arab countries, right, where we look at them and they're so admirable and they say all the right things and the only problem is that they represent sort of 5% of the population? Or was this set of ideas around the rule of law and around stable constitutional government, did it actually have a real constituency or do we know?
I don't think we really know. Let me give you on one side the bad news. I don't think Maklakov ever actually contemplated forming a political party of his own. Or if he did contemplate it, he rejected it. There's a letter that he wrote in 1912, I think, in which he talks about a cadet party more along his lines. And he writes that such a party would not win big in the Duma elections.
In 1917, he is dispatched to be the ambassador to France of the provisional government. The Bolshevik Revolution happens like while he's on the way, right?
The exact timing is not clear, but it is clear that he can't make it to the Quai d'Orsay in Paris to present his credentials before the provisional government has fallen.
And so he spends basically the rest of his life in France.
Yes.
So give us the sort of final act of the story. Who was he during the Bolshevik period?
Well, the first 7 years, he's sort of ambassador without a country because France didn't recognize the Bolshevik regime until 1924. So the 7 years in which if he didn't occupy it, the Russian embassy would be empty. So he did occupy it and represented a remnant, I guess one could say, of Russia. Now, there were really two areas where that was significant. One was an effort to represent Russia, sort of long-term Russian interests in the Paris Peace Conference and the negotiations which led up to it. The difficulty with that was that the great powers were not awfully interested in what he had to say. They didn't think the Bolsheviks would last, but they had no idea what might follow the Bolsheviks. So there was that effort, which I think he did as well as he could, but was doomed. The other project was sort of running interference between the Russian emigre community and French authorities, and above all, trying to get the best deal he could for them. He was somewhat hard. There were French politicians who spoke in very disparaging terms of the Russian emigre community, and at the same time participated in denying them work permits. So they were accused of being layabouts while they were denied an opportunity to work. And they did find work. You know, people who could have been engineers or lawyers or doctors were famously waiters in Paris restaurants. But I think he was quite effective. There seems to have been some funding. Part of it came from the United States State Department for Russian diplomatic activities in France after the war. And then there came a time when France itself created an Office of Refugees and appointed Maklakov as head of it. So the French named him as their choice of the Russian emigre community's ambassador to itself.
How did the Soviet regime regard him?
Interestingly, there is a segment of the emigre community which is so overwhelmed by the marvels, and in certain respects they were marvels, of the Soviet success against the Nazis, that they became ardently pro-Stalin. Maklakov was not in that category, but he, unlike some people, he thought two things, I think. One is that obtaining victory over Nazi Germany was staggeringly important and something to be recognized in itself. And second, that whatever the faults of Stalin, and I think he would have been quick to identify many of them, he had enabled Russia to perform a extraordinary accomplishment of defeating the Nazi invasion. And from that, they developed in Maklakov's mind quite unrealistic hopes of what might happen with the Soviet government in the future.
So he never lost the reformist instinct, even as imagined Stalin.
That's true.
I want to float a comparison by you and get your reaction to it. It's an early 20th century Russian Edmund Burke.
That's interesting. Because Edmund Burke was a political figure in a country that he believed worked pretty well, worked by a process of steady reform. And then, of course, he famously looks across the channel at France and sees it dissolving into chaos for failure to follow that approach.
But he also supports the reformism of the American Revolution.
Absolutely. No, absolutely.
And he's an advocate of Irish rights.
Yes.
In precisely the sort of way that Maklakov is an advocate of Jewish, Polish, and Finnish rights.
Yes.
A moderate reformist, but an opponent of radical reform.
Yes, yes. Well, and actually, I do at one point in the book draw this analogy between Maklakov and Milyukov, the head of the Constitutional Democratic Party, who had all these abstract ideas that he held very passionately. That pair, and on the other hand, the pair of Edmund Burke and Thomas Paine, and again, it's a gradual reformist approach and a respect for tradition with a notion that mankind can draw up an ideal regime and implement it. Maklakov was quite scoffing of that notion throughout, I think, the period.
So I want to bring it back to the present day. We are, as we discussed earlier, in an environment in which people with radical schemes of various stripes have captured a lot of people's imaginations, and in which the Russian state is kind of weirdly stoking that in other countries, even as it has a kind of rigid authoritarianism domestically of a sort that is not wholly unlike the late Tsarist period, which is to say certain structural forms that look quasi-democratic with a very heavy autocratic overlay.
Before, I know this is an introduction to a question, but before you go too far, I want to say that I feel from intense involvement in this pre-revolutionary period that Russia's prospects then were far superior to what they are today.
And why is that?
Well, if you look at the political spectrum, let's look at the regime itself. It consists, in fact, of, I mean, all regimes are coalitions of some kind, but it was really quite a broad coalition. There's a reform of the rural judicial system that is proposed in the Third Duma, which Maklakov supports and tries to push farther. Where did it come from? It came from the Russian imperial bureaucracy. There were reforms in tax which came from the inside of the Russian bureaucracy. So there's a very strong reformist element there. Now, a lot of the time, perhaps most of the time, it doesn't carry the day. And I would certainly never argue that Nicholas II had any distinct reformist tendency. I think you have to classify him as at best a reactionary, but he was a terrific waffler, which in a reactionary
Putin is not,
which Putin is not, and in a reactionary, a tendency to waffle has got to be counted as quite a plus.
I'm not sure I can think of more damning with faint praise. But look, I'm interested for your sense of looking around the world today, domestically, internationally. Are we marginalizing our Maklakovs today? And who are the people around the world that you look at and say, this person is playing the role today that Maklakov played then?
Well, I don't want to name names, but I do think party affiliation can easily be carried much too far on both. That's true, in my view, with respect to both parties. So I think there are people who persist in advocating the policy approaches that they believe are correct, and they try to tamp down fiery rhetoric.
So you sound here a little bit like the founding era suspicion of what they call faction and what we call party. And you seem to be saying that the sort of slavish devotion to party platforms and party positions rather than independent-minded advocacy of policy is part of the problem and part of what you see him as having resisted in his day, though imperfectly, because, of course, he does affiliate with the party in a way that did not always necessarily show him at his best. We live in an age, and we live in a two-party system, for better or for worse, in which it is very difficult to quite imagine how you operationalize that.
I mean,
I've certainly spent as much of my career as I have been able to kind of resisting party affiliation. And yet the other day I wrote a piece with Jonathan Rauch in The Atlantic saying there is a moral requirement for partisanship in this environment. And
I haven't seen that. I'd be very interested to see that.
you may be appalled by it. You're in perhaps the easiest place in the world to resist partisanship, which is in a life-tenured environment on the federal bench in which everything gets presented in a very issue-scrubbed, and the appellate level, no less, right? And so I guess the question is, what's the mechanism for the preservation of that independent space, which even Maklakoff couldn't quite do?
There was an article in the Washington Post magazine a few months ago, which called for proposals to solve the polarization problem. They all seemed to be nonsense. They, with one exception, seemed to involve having some new rule imposed on everything by the government. That seemed to be most unlikely to have the transformative effect that was expected. The exception was this, and it was offered as a joke, I hasten to add, and I offer it as a joke. Take a libertarian to lunch. and I think the driving thought was that libertarians don't fit very well into the divisions of left and right in this country. So they offer surprises and necessarily relatively independent forms of thought. But beyond taking a libertarian to lunch, always a good idea, is to read Alan Jacobs' book, How to Think. And I think it seemed to me very impressive. It talks about the repugnant cultural other and how to frame your words, your language, everything in a way that prevent your communications from just barricading that person off. And his central example is this woman who is the daughter or granddaughter of the founder of the Westboro Baptist Church. I don't know if you know of that, for listeners who don't, famous for its slogan, God hates gays, and so on. A web designer, I think Jacobs identifies him as, starts to engage with her in response to her Twitter emanations, and with a combination of humor and calmness and just sort of asking questions and approaching her as a fellow human being. Somewhat, it's not clear how far he succeeds in detaching her, but at least enough so that she will no longer carry signs with these inflammatory and revolting messages. And so he finds the chink in the armor. And I guess I think we all need, I'm sure I need, to try to improve my way of presenting any issue in such a way that it can reach people who perhaps to me are at some level the repugnant cultural other.
So when you read that anecdote or that account in the book, did you think of Maklakoff?
I did, yes. But that doesn't mean anything because I'm always thinking of Maklakoff.
Stephen Williams, the book is The Reformer, How One Liberal Fought to Preempt the Russian Revolution. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ben.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Okay, most of you, I'm sure, have promoted the Lawfare Podcast and left a rating for us. But some of you guys are slacking and haven't done it yet because we have tens of thousands of downloads and only thousands of reviews. So if you haven't done it, just do it. Get on it. Our music is, of course, performed by the one, the only, the Sophia Yan, who has left a rating for the Lawfare Podcast, by the way. You need to do so, too. And, of course, thanks for listening.